voicemail, fax, letter, and so on. Being flooded with intermittent messages puts people in a reactive mode, as though they are continually putting out small brush fires. The biggest impact is on concentration. Each message serves as a distraction, making it all the harder to return with full focus to the interrupted task at hand. The cumulative effect of the message deluge is chronic distractedness. Indeed, a study of daily productivity in jobs like engineering found that one major cause of low performance was frequent distractions. One outstanding engineer, though, found a strategy that let him stay focused. He wore headphones while working away at his keyboard. Everyone thought he was listening to music, but he was actually listening to nothing. The headphones were just to keep the phone and co-workers from breaking his concentration. Such strategies may work to some extent, but we also need the inner resources to handle the feelings that stress triggers within us. The Just Say No neurons. The prefrontal lobes ordinarily keep the amygdala's urges in check, bringing to this raw impulse judgment, an understanding of the rules of life, and a sense of what response is most skillful and appropriate. These just say no circuits reassure the frantic amygdala that we are not, in fact, in danger, and that a less desperate mode of response will do. The basic design of the brain is built around a simple opposition. Some neurons initiate action, others inhibit that same action. From the finely tuned orchestration of these counterposed tendencies comes smooth execution, whether it be the delivery of a persuasive pitch or the precise incision made by a skilled surgeon. When people are too impulsive, the trouble seems to be in the operation of the prefrontal inhibitory circuitry for impulse rather than in the amygdala. Such individuals are not overly eager to act, so much as unable to stop once they've started. Because the amygdala is the brain's alarm, it has the power to override the prefrontal lobe within a split second to meet the emergency it proclaims. The prefrontal lobes, on the other hand, cannot quickly and directly override the amygdala. Instead, the prefrontal lobes have an array of inhibitory neurons, capable of stopping the directives the amygdala so frantically sends, much like punching in the secret code that shuts down a home security system's false alarm. Richard Davidson, the director of the Laboratory for Affective Neuroscience at the University of Wisconsin, conducted a landmark series of brain imaging studies that tested two groups of people, one identified as highly resilient to life's ups and downs, the other easily upset by them. Davidson tracked their brain function as they performed stressful tasks, such as writing about the most upsetting experience in their lives, or performing difficult math problems under time pressure. The resilient people had a remarkably rapid recovery from stress, with their prefrontal areas starting to calm the amygdala and them within seconds. The more vulnerable people, by contrast, saw a continued escalation of their amygdala's activity and their distress for several minutes after the stressful activity ended. The resilient people had already started to inhibit the distress during the stressful encounter, Davidson says. These are optimistic, action-oriented people. If something goes wrong in their lives, they immediately start to think about how to make it better. This inhibitory circuit between the prefrontal lobes and the amygdala underlies many of the self-regulation competencies, especially self-control under stress, and the ability to adapt to change, both of which allow calm in the face of those existential facts of work life, crisis, uncertainty, and shifting challenges. The prefrontal lobe's ability to inhibit the amygdala's message preserves mental clarity and keeps our actions on a steady course. To go from the laboratory to reality, consider the cost to a business when a manager, the chief decision maker and people handler, does poorly at this most basic emotional skill. A study of store managers at a large American retail chain found that the managers who were most tense, beleaguered, or overwhelmed by job pressures ran stores with the worst performance, as measured four ways: by net profits, sales per square foot, and sales per employee, and per dollar of inventory investment. And those who stayed most composed under the same pressures had the best per store sales records. The Marshmallow Kids grow up and go to work. Six friends, all in college, were drinking and playing cards late into the night when an argument broke out. Mac and Ted's disagreement got louder and angrier until Mac flew into a rage, yelling and screaming, at which point Ted became noticeably cool and reserved. But Mac's temper was now out of control. He stood up and challenged Ted to a fight. Ted responded to Mac's goading very calmly, saying he'd consider fighting Mac, but only if they finished playing the card game. Mac, though boiling with rage, agreed. During the several minutes it took to play out the game, everyone else took Ted's lead and finished the game as though nothing much had happened. This gave Mac time to settle down and collect his thoughts. At the end of the hand, Ted calmly told Mac, "Now, if you would like to discuss this further, I'll step outside." But Mac, who by now had had time to quiet down and think things over, apologized for his temper, and there was no fight. They met again 20 years later at their school reunion. Ted had a successful career in commercial real estate, while Mac was out of work and struggling with drugs and alcohol. The contrast between Mac and Ted is a telling testimony of the benefits of being able to say no to impulse. The key circuitry here is an array of inhibitory neurons in the prefrontal lobes that can veto the impulsive messages that come from the emotional centers, primarily the amygdala, in moments of rage and temptation. For Ted, that circuit apparently operated well. For Mac, it too often failed. The tale of Mac and Ted parallels neatly the life trajectory of two groups of children I wrote about in Emotional Intelligence, who were part of an experiment at Stanford University known as the Marshmallow Test. Briefly, 4-year-olds in the Stanford preschool were brought into a room one by one. A marshmallow was put on the table in front of them, and they were told, "You can have this marshmallow now if you want, but if you don't eat it until after I run an errand, you can have 2 when I return." Some 14 years later, as they were graduating from high school, the children who ate the marshmallow right away were compared with those who waited and got 2. Those who grabbed, compared to those who waited, were more likely to fall apart under stress, tended to become irritated and pick fights more often, and were less able to resist temptation in pursuit of their goals. Most surprising to the researchers, though, was a completely unanticipated effect. Those children who had waited for the marshmallow, compared to those who hadn't, had scores averaging a remarkable 210 points higher out of a possible 1,600 on the SAT, the college entrance exam. My best guess as to why impulsivity should diminish learning ability harks back to the link between amygdala and prefrontal lobes. As the source of emotional impulse, the amygdala is the font of distraction. The prefrontal lobes are the site of working memory, the capacity to pay attention to what is on our mind at the moment. To the extent we are preoccupied by emotionally driven thoughts, we have that much less attentional space left in working memory. For a school child, this means less attention to pay to the teacher, to a book, to homework. If this persists over years and years, the result is the deficiency in learning that was revealed by the lower SAT scores. The same is true for someone at work. The cost of impulsivity and distractedness is a hampered ability to learn or adapt. As the children in the Stanford study grew into adulthood and joined the workforce, the differences became even more pronounced. In their late 20s, those who had resisted the marshmallow in childhood were still more intellectually skilled, more attentive, and better able to concentrate. They were better able to develop genuine and close relationships, were more dependable and responsible, and showed better self-control in the face of frustration. By contrast, those who grabbed the marshmallow at 4 were now, in their late 20s, less cognitively adept and strikingly less emotionally competent than those who had restrained themselves. They were more often loners, they were less dependable, more easily distracted, and unable to delay gratification in pursuing their goals. When stressed, they had little tolerance or self-control. They responded to pressure with little flexibility, instead repeating the same futile and overblown response time and again. The story of the marshmallow kids holds larger lessons about the cost of out-of-control emotions. When we are under the sway of impulse, agitation, and emotionality, our ability to think and work suffers. The managed heart. Emotional self-regulation includes not just damping down distress or stifling impulse. It can also mean intentionally eliciting an emotion, even an unpleasant one. Some bill collectors, I'm told, prime themselves for calls on people by getting themselves worked up into an irritable, ill-tempered state. Physicians, who have to give bad news to patients or their families, put themselves in a suitably somber, dour mood, as do morticians meeting with bereaved families. In retail and service industries, exhortations to be friendly to customers are virtually universal. One school of thought argues that when workers are ordered to display a given emotion, they have to perform an onerous emotional labor in order to keep their job. When the dictates of the boss determines the emotions a person must express, the result is an estrangement from one's own feelings. Retail clerks, flight attendants, and hotel staff are among the workers prone to such attempted management of the heart, which Arlie Hochschild, a psychologist at the University of California, Berkeley, calls a commercialization of human feelings that amounts to a form of emotional tyranny. A closer look reveals this perspective to be only half the story. Critical in determining whether emotional labor is onerous or not is how much the person identifies with the job. For a nurse who sees herself as a caring, compassionate person, taking a few moments to console a patient in distress represents not a burden, but what makes her job more meaningful. The notion of emotional self-control does not mean denying or repressing true feelings. Bad moods, for instance, have their uses. Anger, sadness, and fear can become sources of creativity, energy, and connectedness. Anger can be an intense source of motivation, particularly when it stems from the urge to right an injustice or inequity. Shared sadness can knit people together, and the urgency born of anxiety, if not overwhelming, can prod the creative spirit. Emotional self-control is not the same as over-control, the stifling of all feeling and spontaneity. In fact, there is a physical and mental cost to such over-control. People who stifle their feelings, especially strong negative ones, raise their heart rate, a sign of increased tension. When such emotional suppression is chronic, it can impair thinking, hamper intellectual performance, and interfere with smooth social interactions. By contrast, emotional competence implies we have a choice as to how we express our feelings. Such emotional finesse becomes particularly important in a global economy, since the ground rules for emotional expression vary greatly from culture to culture. What is appropriate in one country may appear an unseemly outburst in another. For example, executives from emotionally reserved cultures, like those in Northern Europe, can be seen as cold and aloof by Latin American business partners. In the United States, being emotionally unexpressive often communicates a negative message, a sense of distance or indifference. One study of nearly 2,000 supervisors, managers, and executives in American companies showed a strong link between lack of spontaneity and poor performance. While superior managers were more spontaneous than their mediocre peers, executives as a group were more controlled in expressing their personal feelings than managers at lower levels. The executives apparently gave more consideration to the impact of expressing the wrong feeling in a given situation. That measured approach in the top tiers speaks to the sense in which the workplace is a special case when it comes to emotions, almost a culture apart from the rest of life. Within the intimate zone of friends and family, we can bring up and mull over whatever weighs on our heart, and should. At work, a different set of emotional ground rules more often prevails. Self-regulation, managing impulse as well as distressing feelings, depends on the working of the emotional centers in tandem with the brain's executive centers in the prefrontal areas. These two primal skills, handling impulse and dealing with upsets, are at the core of five emotional competencies. Self-control, managing disruptive emotions and impulses effectively. Trustworthiness, displaying honesty and integrity. Conscientiousness, dependability and responsibility in fulfilling obligations. Adaptability, flexibility in handling change and challenges. Innovation, being open to novel ideas, approaches, and new information. Self-control, keeping disruptive emotions and impulses under control. People with this competence, manage their impulsive feelings and distressing emotions well. Stay composed, positive, and unflappable even in trying moments. Think clearly and stay focused under pressure. Bill Gates is pissed. His eyes are bulging, and his oversized glasses are askew. His face is flushed, and spit is flying from his mouth. He's in a small, crowded conference room at the Microsoft campus with 20 young Microsofties gathered around an oblong table. Most look at their chairman with outright fear, if they look at him at all. The sour smell of sweaty terror fills the room. So begins the narrative of a demonstration of the high art of handling emotions. While Gates continues his angry tirade, the hapless programmers fumble and stutter, trying to persuade or at least placate him. All to no avail. No one seems to be able to get through, except a small, soft-spoken Chinese-American woman, who seems to be the only person in the room who is unfazed by his tantrum. She looks him in the eye while everyone else avoids eye contact. Twice she interrupts his tirade to address him in quiet tones. The first time, her words seem to calm him a bit before his shouting resumes. The second time, he listens in silence, thoughtfully gazing down at the table. Then his anger suddenly vanishes, and he tells her, "Okay, this looks good. Go ahead." With that, he ends the meeting. What the woman said was not much different from what the others had been saying, but her unflappability may well have allowed her to say it better, to think clearly rather than being swamped by anxiety. Her manner was certainly part of her message, sending the signal that the tirade did not intimidate her, that she could take it without becoming unhinged, that there was no real reason to be so agitated. This skill is, in a sense, largely invisible. Self-control manifests largely in the absence of more obvious emotional fireworks. Signs include being unfazed under stress or handling a hostile person without lashing out in return. Another mundane example is time management. Keeping ourselves on a daily schedule demands self-control, if only to resist seemingly urgent but actually trivial demands, or the lure of time-wasting pleasures or distractions. The ultimate act of personal responsibility at work may be in taking control of our own state of mind. Moods exert a powerful pull on thought, memory, and perception. When we are angry, we more readily remember incidents that support our ire. Our thoughts become preoccupied with the object of our anger, and irritability so skews our worldview that an otherwise benign comment might now strike us as hostile. Resisting this despotic quality of moods is essential to our ability to work productively. Is hell. Many years ago, I had a newly promoted boss who struck me as vastly ambitious. His strategy for looking good in his new post was to hire fresh writers, his people, and make sure their work got prominent display in the publication. He would spend a great deal of time with the new folks while studiously ignoring us old hands. Perhaps my boss was under pressure from his boss. I never knew his motivation. But one day, to my surprise, he asked me to have a cup of coffee with him in the company cafeteria. There, after a few words of perfunctory small talk, he abruptly informed me that my work was not up to standards. Exactly how I didn't meet standards was vague. Under a former boss, my work had been nominated for major awards. But the consequence was clear. If I didn't improve, he would fire me. Needless to say, that caused me tremendous, relentless anxiety. Over my head in debt and with children heading for college, I desperately needed that job. Worse, writing itself demands high levels of concentration, and those worries kept intruding, distracting me with vivid fantasies of career and financial catastrophe. What saved my sanity was a relaxation technique I had learned years before, a simple meditation practice that I had done on and off for years. Though I had been lackadaisical in using it, now I became fanatical, allowing myself a half hour or even a full hour of calming centeredness every morning before I started my day. It worked. I kept myself together and sane, doing my best to turn out workmanlike articles on demand. And then came relief. My unbearable boss got his promotion to another department. People best able to handle distress often have a stress management technique they call on when needed, whether it's a long bath, a workout, or a yoga session, as I did with meditation. Having such a relaxation method in our repertoire does not mean that we won't feel upset and distressed from time to time, but regular daily practice of a relaxation method seems to reset the trigger point for the amygdala, making it less easily provoked. This neural resetting gives us the ability to recover more quickly from amygdala hijacks while making us less prone to them in the first place. The net result is that we are susceptible to distress less often, and our bouts are shorter. A sense of helplessness. The feeling of helplessness about work pressures is in itself pernicious. Among small business owners and employees, those with a stronger sense that they control what happens to them in life are less likely to become angry, depressed, or agitated when faced with conflicts and strains on the job. But those who feel little control are more prone to getting upset or even quitting. In a study of 7,400 men and women in London civil service jobs, those who felt they had to meet deadlines imposed by someone else and had little say in how they did their work or with whom they did it had a 50% higher risk of developing symptoms of coronary heart disease than those with more job flexibility. Feeling little control over the demands and pressures of the work we have to do holds as great a risk of heart disease as risk factors like hypertension. That is why, of all the relationships we have at work, the one with our boss or supervisor has the greatest impact on our emotional and physical health. When volunteers at a British colds research unit were exposed to a cold virus and followed for 5 days to see who would get sick, it turned out that those entangled in social tensions were the most susceptible. An isolated tough day at the office was not a problem, but having persistent trouble with a superior was stressful enough to lower immune resilience. In the newly discovered anatomical links between brain and body that connect our mental state with physical health, the emotional centers play the critical role, with the richest web of connection to both the immune system and the cardiovascular system. These biological ties explain why distressing feelings, sadness, frustration, anger, tension, intense anxiety, double the risk that someone with heart disease may experience a dangerous decrease in blood flow to the heart within hours of having these feelings. Such decreases can sometimes trigger a heart attack. It is no news to working mothers that they bear a unique psychological burden as ordinary work pressures are compounded by the mental strain of being on call for unexpected family problems, like a sick child. Single and married mothers alike who hold mid-level jobs where they have little control have substantially higher levels of cortisol, the stress hormone, than do their counterparts at work who do not have children at home. At low levels, cortisol can help the body fight a virus or heal damaged tissues, but when too much cortisol flows, it diminishes the effectiveness of the immune system. As one researcher at the National Institute of Mental Health put it, if you're sitting there watching the stock market crash, your cortisol from the psychological stress is going to be up. Then, if someone coughs in your face, you're going to be susceptible to getting the flu. How self-awareness pays off. A college professor with heart problems was given a portable heart rate monitor to wear, because when his heart rate exceeded 150 beats per minute, too little oxygen reached his heart muscle. One day, the professor went to one of the regular, seemingly endless departmental meetings, which he felt were a waste of time. But he learned from the monitor that, while he thought he was cynically detached from the discussions, his heart was pounding away at dangerous levels. He had not realized until then how emotionally upset he was by the daily tussle of departmental politics. Self-awareness pays off as a key skill in handling stress. Without careful attention, we can, like the college professor, be surprisingly oblivious to just how stressful our work life really is. Simply bringing simmering feelings into awareness can have salutary effects. When 63 laid-off managers participated in a study at Southern Methodist University, many were, understandably, angry and hostile. Half were told to keep a journal for 5 days, spending 20 minutes writing out their deepest feelings and reflections on what they were going through. Those who kept journals found new jobs faster than those who didn't. The more accurately we can monitor our emotional upsets, the sooner we can recover from distress. Consider an experiment in which people watch a graphic anti-drunk driving film depicting bloody automobile accidents. During the half hour after the film, viewers report feeling distressed and depressed, with their thoughts repeatedly going back to the troubling scenes they've just witnessed. The quickest to recover are those with the greatest clarity about their feelings. Emotional clarity, it seems, enables us to manage bad moods. Unflappability, however, does not necessarily mean we have done the job. Even when people seem unflappable, if they are actually seething inside, they still need to handle their troubled feelings. Some cultures, particularly those in Asia, encourage this pattern of masking negative feelings. While this may keep relationships tranquil, it can have a cost to the individual. A psychologist teaching emotional intelligence abilities to flight attendants in Asia said, "Imploding is the problem there. They don't explode. They hold it in and suffer." Emotional implosion has several drawbacks. Imploders often fail to take any action to better their situation. They may not show outward signs of an emotional hijack, but they suffer the internal fallout anyway. Headaches, edginess, smoking and drinking too much, sleeplessness, endless self-criticism. And they have the same health risks as those who explode, and so need to learn to manage their own reactions to distress. Self-control in action. It's a classic Manhattan street scene. A man stops his Lexus in a no-stopping zone on a busy street, hurries into a shop, makes a few purchases, and rushes out, only to find a traffic cop who has not only written out a ticket, but also called a tow truck, to which his Lexus is now being hitched. "God damn!" the man explodes in rage, screaming at the traffic cop. "You are the lowest form of human slime," he yells, pounding the hood of the tow truck with his fist. The cop, visibly ruffled, somehow manages a calm response. "It's the law. If you think it's wrong, you can appeal." And with that, he turns and walks away. Self-control is crucial for those in law enforcement. When facing someone who is in the throes of an amygdala hijack, like the abusive motorist, the odds of the encounter ending in violence will escalate rapidly if the officer involved gets hijacked by his or her amygdala too. Indeed, Officer Michael Wilson, who teaches at New York City's Police Academy, says these situations make many officers struggle to handle their visceral response to disrespect, an attitude they see not just as an idle threat, but as signaling a shift in power in the interaction, which could pose a danger to their life. As Wilson puts it, "Initially, when someone gives you major grief, your body wants to react. But there is this little person inside your head saying, 'It's not worth it. I put my hands on this person, I lose.'" The training of police, at least in the United States, which sadly has one of the highest levels of violence in the world, requires a careful titration of the use of force in amounts that correspond to the situation at hand. Threats, physical intimidation, and drawing a gun are last resorts, since each of these is itself likely to incite an amygdala hijack in the other person. Competence studies in law enforcement organizations find outstanding officers use the least force necessary, approach volatile people calmly and with a professional demeanor, and are adept at de-escalation. A study of New York City traffic cops found that those who managed a calm response, even when faced with angry motorists, had the fewest incidents escalate into outright violence. The principle of remaining calm despite provocation applies to anyone who routinely faces obnoxious or agitated people on the job. Among counselors and psychotherapists, for example, superior performers respond calmly to a personal attack by a patient. So do outstanding flight attendants faced with disgruntled passengers. And among managers and executives, superior performers balance their drive, ambition, and assertiveness with self-control, harnessing their personal needs in the service of the organization's goals. Resilience, thriving on stress. Compare two executives at one of America's regional telephone companies, a company where stress has soared as the entire industry undergoes wrenching changes. One of the executives is plagued by tension. "My life seems like a rat race. I'm always trying to catch up, meet deadlines imposed on me. But most aren't even important. They're just routine. So even though I'm nervous and tense, I'm also bored a lot of the time." The other executive says, "I'm almost never bored. Even when there's something I have to do that doesn't strike me as interesting at first, usually once I get into it, I find it worthwhile in a way that teaches me something. I'm always out there straining to make a difference, to shape a productive work life for myself." The first executive was identified as low in, and the second high in, a quality called hardiness, the ability to stay committed, feel in control, and be challenged rather than threatened by stress. The study found that those who react to stress with hardiness, seeing work as strenuous but exciting, and change as a chance to develop rather than as an enemy, bear the physical burden of stress much better, coming through with less illness. A paradox of work life is that a situation can be seen by one person as a devastating threat, but by another as an invigorating challenge. With the right emotional resources, what seems threatening can be taken instead as a challenge and met with energy, even enthusiasm. There is a crucial difference in brain function between good stress, the challenges that mobilize and motivate us, and bad stress, the threats that overwhelm, paralyze, or demoralize us. The brain chemicals that generate enthusiasm for a challenge are different from those that respond to stress and threat. They are at work when our energy is high, our effort maximal, and our mood positive. The biochemistry of these productive states revolves around activating the sympathetic nervous system and the adrenals to secrete chemicals called catecholamines. The catecholamines, adrenaline, and noradrenaline, arouse us to action in a more productive way than the frantic urgency of cortisol. Once the brain goes into its emergency mode, it starts pumping out cortisol as well as vastly elevated levels of catecholamines. But we do our best work at a lower level of brain arousal, when only the catecholamine system is engaged. And it doesn't take a threat to our job or a negative comment from the boss to activate cortisol. Boredom, impatience, frustration, even tiredness will do it. In a sense, then, there are two kinds of stress, good and bad, and two distinct biological systems at work. There is also a balance point where the sympathetic nervous system is pumping, but not too much. Our mood is positive, and our ability to think and react is optimal. Here lies our peak performance. Trustworthiness and conscientiousness. Maintaining integrity and taking responsibility for personal performance. People with this competence for trustworthiness act ethically and are above reproach. Build trust through their reliability and authenticity. Admit their own mistakes and confront unethical actions in others. Take tough, principled stands even if they are unpopular. For conscientiousness, meet commitments and keep promises. Hold themselves accountable for meeting their objectives. Are organized and careful in their work. The inventor of a promising new product, a two-chamber air mattress that had the competitive advantage of preserving body heat, tells of talking to a businessman who offered to manufacture and sell the mattresses, giving the inventor a royalty. The businessman, over the course of their conversation, revealed with some pride that he never paid any taxes. "How do you do it?" the inventor asked, incredulous. "I keep two sets of books," the businessman replied smugly. "So which set of books will you use to record the sales of my mattresses to compute the royalty you owe me?" the inventor asked. To that question there was no reply. End of deal. Credibility stems from integrity. Stars know that trustworthiness at work translates into letting people know one's values and principles, intentions and feelings, and acting in ways that are reliably consistent with them. They are forthright about their own mistakes and confront others about their lapses. Workers with integrity are frank, even acknowledging their feelings. I was getting a little nervous about that, which contributes to their aura of authenticity. By contrast, those who never admit a lapse or imperfection, or who hype themselves, their company, or a product, undermine their credibility. Integrity, acting openly, honestly, and consistently, sets apart outstanding performers in jobs of every kind. Take those in sales roles that depend on the strength of ongoing relationships. In such a job, someone who hides crucial information, breaks promises, or fails to fulfill commitments undermines the trust so vital to repeat business. Of the general managers for sales who've worked for me and washed out, the single thing they lacked most was trustworthiness, a senior vice president at a division of automatic data processors told me. In sales, it's trade-offs. I'll give you this if you give me a concession on that. It's an ambiguous situation where you have to take someone's word for it. A field like finance, that's more science than art. It's more clear-cut. But in sales, it's grays, so being trustworthy is all the more important. Douglas Lenick, Executive Vice President of American Express Financial Advisors, concurs. Some people have the mistaken impression you can succeed in business by cheating people or pressuring them into buying something they don't need. That may work for you in the short term, but it will undermine you in the long run. You'll be far more successful if you stay in alignment with your personal values. When business is business. I met her on a plane, seatmate for a few hours on a flight out west. We'd been chatting for a while when she found out I was writing about emotions at work. Then her story spilled out. We do safety testing for the chemical industry, assessing their materials and how they handle them for risks like combustibility. We verify that their procedures for handling these substances meet federal safety standards. But my boss doesn't care if the report is accurate. He just wants it done on time. His motto is, get the job done quick as you can and get the money. I recently found that the calculations for one job were wrong, so I redid them. But the boss gave me grief about it because it took more time than he wanted. I have to do what this guy tells me, even though I know he's incompetent. So I'm always redoing calculations at home, on my own time. Everyone's unhappy that the boss pushes us this way. Why does she put up with it? She tells me about a messy divorce, having to take care of her two children on her own, being stretched. I'd leave if I could, but I need the work. Jobs are tight just now. After a long, reflective silence, she continues. He signs all the work. Now I'm relieved. I don't want my name on those reports. It doesn't feel right to me. There haven't been any accidents, like fires or explosions, but there might be someday. Shouldn't she speak up, report what's going on? I've thought about saying something to someone, but I can't say anything because I signed a secrecy agreement when I was hired. I'd have to leave the company and then be able to prove in court what I said. That would be a nightmare. As our plane taxis in for a landing, she seems at once relieved and nervous about what she's revealed. So anxious, she won't tell me her name or that of her company. Still, she takes my name and number, saying she has more to say. She'll call me. She never does. The Ethics Officer Association commissioned a survey of 1,300 workers at all levels in American companies, and what they found is startling. About half admitted to engaging in unethical business practices. For the most part, breaches of trust or codes of morality were relatively minor, such as calling in sick when they want time off, or taking home supplies from the company cabinet. But 9% admitted lying or deceiving a customer. 6% have falsified numbers in reports or documents. And 5% have lied to superiors on serious matters or withheld critical information. And 4% admitted to having taken credit for someone else's work or idea. Some of the breaches are extremely serious. 3% have engaged in a copyright or software infringement. And 2% have forged someone's name on a document. 1% have recorded false information when filing government forms, such as tax returns. By contrast, a study of outstanding accountants at one of America's largest firms discovered that one distinction was a competence called courage. They were willing to stand up to their clients and against pressures at their own accounting firms to risk losing an account to insist people do what was right. And the best accountants had the courage to speak up against even massive resistance to be sure the rules were followed, a stance requiring immense integrity and self-confidence. There was a good news, bad news edge to this finding. The good news was that their best accountants had this kind of courage. The bad news was that most of their accountants did not. Impulse control, an emotional fault line. A corporate controller was fired because he sexually harassed the women who worked for him. He was also intensely aggressive in dealing with people generally. An executive at another company was by nature outgoing, talkative, friendly, and spontaneous, but also had little self-restraint. He was fired for leaking company secrets. The head of a small industrial company was charged with criminal behavior in managing his company's funds. He had selected a chief financial officer, an accomplice, who shared with him both a lack of conscience and little apprehension about the consequences of what they were doing. These case studies of wrecked careers come from the files of a consulting company that assessed each of these executives in the course of testing 4,265 people, from company heads to blue-collar workers. They all had a lack of impulse control, with little or no ability to delay gratification. With self-restraint, people can think through the potential consequences of what they are about to do and assume responsibility for their words and deeds. The consulting firm that did the study of self-restraint in professions recommends that, in general, when selecting people for industrial jobs at all levels, it is wise to reject candidates who are low or very low in self-restraint, since the odds of them creating problems of some kind are extremely high. It does note, though, that people can be helped to handle their impulsivity better. Poor impulse control need not be a sentence to a dead-end career. Even among football players, whose very role would seem to demand a certain level of spontaneous aggressiveness, restraint pays. In a study of more than 700 pros, NFL draft choices, and college players, those with higher levels of restraint were rated by their coaches as being more motivated, having better abilities as football players, being better leaders, and being easier to coach. On the other hand, those with low levels of restraint were rated as showing little respect for teammates and coaches and were unwilling to listen or take direction. They were cavalier about their agreements or contracts, used insulting trash talk with opponents, and indulged in show-offish end zone dancing. Take two football players with very low levels of restraint. One was found to be using drugs, and the other was a troublemaker who punched and knocked out a teammate during practice. Quiet virtue, the conscientious. By contrast, the everyday signs of conscientiousness, being punctual, careful in doing work, self-disciplined, and scrupulous in attending to responsibilities, are hallmarks of the model organizational citizen, the people who keep things running as they should. They follow the rules, help out, and are concerned about the people they work with. It's the conscientious worker who helps orient newcomers or updates people who return after an absence, who gets to work on time, and never abuses sick leaves, who always gets things done on deadline. Conscientiousness is a taproot of success in any field. In studies of job performance, outstanding effectiveness for virtually all jobs, from semi-skilled labor to sales and management, depends on conscientiousness. It is particularly important for outstanding performance in jobs at the lower levels of an organization. The mailroom clerk who never misplaces a package, the secretary whose message taking is impeccable, the delivery truck driver who is always on time. Among sales representatives for a large American appliance manufacturer, those who were most conscientious had the largest volume of sales. Conscientiousness also offers a buffer against the threat of job loss in today's ever-churning market, because employees with this trait are among the most valued. For the sales reps, their level of conscientiousness mattered almost as much as their sales in determining who stayed on. There is an aura of sorts around highly conscientious people that makes them seem even better than they actually are. Their reputation for reliability biases supervisors' ratings of their work, giving them higher evaluations than objective measures of their performance would predict. But conscientiousness, in the absence of empathy or social skills, can lead to problems. Since conscientious people demand so much of themselves, they can hold other people to their own standards, and so be overly judgmental when others don't show the same lofty levels of exemplary behavior. Factory workers in Great Britain and the United States, who were extremely conscientious, for example, tended to criticize co-workers even about mundane lapses that seemed trivial to those they criticized, which strained their relationships. When conscientiousness takes the form of a relentless conformity to expectations, it can put a damper on creativity. In creative callings like art or advertising, openness to wild ideas and spontaneity are at a premium. Success in such occupations calls for a balance, however. Without enough conscientiousness to follow through, people become mere dreamers, with nothing to show for their imaginativeness. Innovation and adaptability. Being open to novel ideas and approaches, and being flexible in responding to change. People with this competence for innovation seek out fresh ideas from a wide variety of sources. Entertain original solutions to problems. Generate new ideas. Take fresh perspectives and risks in their thinking. For adaptability, smoothly handle multiple demands, shifting priorities, and rapid change. Adapt their responses and tactics to fit fluid circumstances. Are flexible in how they see events. It was a subtle signal. Sometime in the mid-1970s, there was a shift in how Intel managers were treated by their peers in Japan. Where before they had been shown lavish respect, now they came back with the vague feeling that they were being viewed with a newfound derision. Something had changed. That report from the front lines was a harbinger of the coming Japanese supremacy in the market for computer chips, at the time Intel's main business. The story is told by Andrew S. Grove, Intel's chairman, as an example of how hard it can be for executives to adapt to shifts in an industry. It took Intel's top management, Grove confesses, several more years to realize that Japanese companies had used their strength in precision manufacturing to beat Intel at its own game, making and selling memory chips. Such moments, when changing circumstances turn a winning strategy sour, are crucial in the history of any company. These moments amount to what Grove calls a valley of death. If a company is not nimble enough to rethink its strategy while it still has the assets and strength to change and adapt, it is doomed to wither or die. In facing such make-or-break moments, the emotional capabilities executives bring to bear make a crucial difference. The ability to be flexible, to take in new, even painful information without tuning out in self-protection, and to respond nimbly is essential. Too often, corporate inertia takes over instead, with top management failing to read the signs of the coming sea change, or fearing to act on the implications, even as the rules of the game are mutating. At Intel, the dominant assumption into the 1980s was that they were a memory company, selling chips, even though by then their share of that market had shrunk to around 3%. Barely noticed was the sideline work that would become their new core business, microprocessors, or what we all now know as Intel Inside. The high-tech industry, perhaps the fastest changing of all, is littered with the remains of companies whose management failed to adapt to market shifts. An engineer who had worked at Wang Laboratories during its heyday in the 1980s, when the company surged to $3 billion in sales, and was there to see the company fail, said, "I've seen what success does. It breeds arrogance. You stop listening to your customers and employees. You get complacent about your business, and finally get leapfrogged by competitors." Change is the constant. Grove contends a company's ability to survive such a looming valley of death depends on one thing: how the top management reacts emotionally. When their very status and well-being, and that of their company, face a great threat, when their most cherished assumptions about their mission and their business are being undermined, what emotions take over? At Intel, adaptability was crucial in facing two major crises: the loss of the memory chip market, and more recently, the disaster when a flaw in the company's then-new Pentium processor made millions of computer owners lose faith in the product. While the latter corporate drama took only about a month to unfold, beginning to end, that short period telescoped a classic management adaptation to challenging new realities. A cycle of initial denial, followed by unavoidable facts, followed by a flood of distress, all of which was resolved when Grove and his top executives came to grips with reality and finally made a wrenching, costly concession. The promise to replace Pentium processors for all who asked, even though it would cost the company $475 million. The $500 million the replacements cost the company was the price for establishing Intel as a commercial brand name. The Intel Inside campaign was intended to make computer buyers perceive that the microprocessor inside the computer is the computer. This built customer loyalty to Intel that went beyond whatever brand of PC they might buy. For any organization to reinvent itself, basic assumptions, visions, strategies, and identities have to be questioned. But people hold emotional attachments to all these elements of their work life, making change all the harder. Consider the disaster at the Schwinn Bicycle Company, America's number one manufacturer of bicycles from the mid-1950s through the 1970s. A family-owned company, Schwinn failed to spot the motocross and mountain biking trends of the 1980s and was slow to match competition from abroad for the booming market in upscale bikes for adults. Top management, oblivious to the changing tides of bikers' tastes, were far too slow in rethinking their marketing strategy. One sales manager even dismissed the new, lightweight bikes with a derisive comment, "Are you going to ride it or carry it?" Its overseas suppliers, including Giant Bicycles of Taiwan, which Schwinn had inadvertently helped build into a bicycle manufacturing titan, were among the creditors that eventually forced Schwinn into bankruptcy in 1992. Such changes in market realities, of course, are an inevitable part of competition in business large and small. An executive at a company that processes data for auto dealers tells me, "One of our main competitors made $400 million a year supplying forms to auto dealers. Then we introduced a way for auto dealers to use computers and laser printers to do away with the forms. We grew to $60 million per year, all business taken from that competitor. Just this month, they finally woke up and introduced a computerized system competitive to ours. But it took them 4 years and cost them a huge piece of their business." Surviving change, the emotional prerequisites. He was brilliant, no question about it. A CPA who also had a master's in economics, an MBA, and additional advanced coursework in finance, all from an Ivy League university. He had been a standout as a credit officer and risk manager for a major global bank for many years. And now he was being fired. The reason? He could not adjust to his new job. His success had won him a place on a team the bank had put together to find promising companies to invest in. Their mandate was to recoup the value of government bonds in countries where they had been devalued up to 80%. Within the countries themselves, the bonds could still be invested at full face value. But instead of helping his team think through the positive scenarios that might make a company a good buy, this former risk manager simply continued with his old, naysaying approach. He kept insisting on analyzing for weakness, for what the downside might be, killing businesses instead of building them, I was told by the executive recruiter he saw when he lost his job. His boss finally got fed up and fired him. He just couldn't adapt to the new goal. At work these days, the constant is change. We used to be very rigid in how we operated. You did it by the book, A, B, C, D. No other way, an advertising sales rep for a major publication told me. But now, we make those decisions ourselves. There's no set formula for how you work. We're encouraged to take risks. Work as teams. The atmosphere has changed. But some people seem at a loss. They just have a hard time with the new way of doing things. People who lack adaptability are ruled by fear, anxiety, and a deep personal discomfort with change. Many managers are having trouble adapting to the trend toward diffusing responsibility and decision-making throughout organizations. As an executive at Siemens AG, the German conglomerate explained, People have old habits of authority. The new model empowers individuals to make decisions themselves, delegating responsibility downward in the hierarchy, closer to the customer. But when things go poorly, say, profitability is down for a month, some managers panic, fall back on their old ways, and tighten up control again. When they do, it undermines the new way of doing things. If there is any competence these times call for, it is adaptability. Stars in this competence relish change and find exhilaration in innovation. They are open to new information and, like the management team at Intel, can let go of old assumptions and so adapt how they operate. They are comfortable with the anxiety that the new or unknown often brings and are willing to take a gamble on a new way of doing things. Adaptability requires the flexibility to take into account multiple perspectives on a given situation. This flexibility depends, in turn, on an emotional strength, the ability to stay comfortable with ambiguity and remain calm in the face of the unexpected. Another competence that supports adaptability is self-confidence, particularly the sureness that allows someone to quickly adjust their responses, even dropping everything without reservation as realities shift. The openness to change that typifies adaptability ties this competence to another that is increasingly prized in these turbulent times. Innovation. The innovators. Levi Strauss, the huge garment manufacturer, faced a dilemma regarding two sewing subcontractors in Bangladesh who were using child laborers. International human rights activists were pressuring Levi Strauss to stop allowing contractors to use underage workers. But company investigators discovered that if the children lost their jobs, they would be impoverished and maybe driven into prostitution. Should the company fire them in a principled stand against child labor? Or keep them on to protect them from a worse fate? The creative solution? Neither. Levi Strauss decided to keep the children on the payroll while they went to school full-time, and then, when they reached 14, the local age of maturity, hire them back. That innovative response offers a model of creative thinking for multinationals seeking to be socially responsible. Coming to such an original resolution demands entertaining ideas that may seem too radical or risky at first glance, yet having the courage to pursue them anyway. The emotional foundation of the innovator at work is taking pleasure in originality. Creativity on the job revolves around applying new ideas to achieve results. People who have this knack can quickly identify key issues and simplify problems that seem overwhelmingly complex. Most important, they can find original connections and patterns that others overlook. People who lack a flair for innovation, by contrast, typically miss the larger picture and get enmeshed in details, and so deal with complex problems only slowly, even tediously. Their fear of risk makes them shy away from novel ideas. And when they try to find solutions, they often fail to realize that what worked in the past is not always the answer for the future. Deficits in this competence can go beyond mere lack of imagination. People who are uncomfortable with risk become critics and naysayers. Defensive and cautious, they may constantly deride or undermine innovative ideas. The creative mind is, by its very nature, a bit unruly. There is a natural tension between orderly self-control and the innovative urge. It's not that people who are creative are out of control emotionally. Rather, they are willing to entertain a wider range of impulse and action than do less adventurous spirits. That is, after all, what creates new possibilities. Self-control, in the sense of following the rules, predicts outstanding performance in large organizations, especially where a bureaucratic sense of doing the right thing is rewarded. But in entrepreneurial companies and in creative jobs like advertising, being overly controlled predicts failure. A German venture capitalist decries the lack of support in his country for the innovative thinking and risk-taking at the heart of entrepreneurial ventures. I hear the same concern voiced in Japan. The German venture capitalist tells me, "Many countries, like my own, are worrying about how to encourage the entrepreneurial skills that create jobs. Risk-taking, and the drive to pursue innovative ideas are the fuel that stokes the entrepreneurial spirit. Old and new paradigms for innovation. The act of innovation